So this is continuing in our tradition of these pedagogical lectures in this workshop. We have had, I think, about 5 lectures on string theory, and we have had some lectures on mathematical relativity and also on computational physics. And now we'll have 4 lectures in the next 4 weeks on this approach to quantum gravity, which is based on quantum geometry. The first 2 lectures, that is today and a week from now, will be sort of introductory, which will set up the general machinery, and also in the next lecture particularly, I will be able to give you some details about quantum geometry itself, that is to say, various operators, how their spectra turn out to be discrete, etc., etc. The third lecture will be given by John Baez, and he will tell us about entropy calculations within this approach. This is for 4-dimensional black holes. And the fourth lecture will be given by Jorge Pullin, and he will tell us about a summary of the status of quantum dynamics. So if you like, you know, solutions to the so-called Wheeler-DeWitt equation, if you like, in this framework. So I just should say that particularly today's lecture is going to be sort of rather introductory because the audience is diverse. And I apologize in advance to people who are experts. I should say that Don knows a lot of this stuff. Also, at the end of the week, I think Lee Smolin and Carlo Rovelli are coming in the very near future, who have worked on this in great detail. And John Baez also will be here. And of course, Kirill Krasina also knows a lot of this stuff, who is here. Okay. So for this lecture, I just first want to talk about, give a few introductory remarks. Then I'll tell you a little bit about change of perspective that one would take in gravitational theories, such as general relativity. Rather than looking at metric as a basic variable, we will turn to connections as basic variables. Then I'll introduce some mathematical tools. This is for quantization, which will enable us to then look at the problem of quantization in a non-perturbative fashion. And finally, in today's last part in today's lecture, I'll just sort of outline the quantization strategy. And in the next lecture, then I'll tell you about the various geometric operators and also about at least set up the problem of quantum dynamics, and then other people can take over. These lectures are meant to be introduction, not only to these 4 pedagogical lectures, but also there will be a bunch of lectures, for example, on so-called spin forms, which are some more recent work and so on, some technical seminars. And so I'll try to cover the preliminary material for all these lectures. Okay. I think Joe gave these lectures on string theory, 2 of them, Joe Polchinski. And he began by saying, "I'm Joe Polchinski, and I believe gravity is a spin 2 field." And so I should sort of begin by saying that the sort of basic premise here is really that gravity geometry. So it's really sort of the opposite or complementary viewpoint.
And,
sorry? Part of geometry. So the statement is that presumably even other things are geometry, but gravity for sure, that's the viewpoint here, is really geometry. And again, I mean, the idea is that this is really the deepest lesson we learned conceptually from Einstein's general relativity. And in fact, some of the most interesting predictions of general relativity, gravity waves and black holes, are pure geometry configurations. And so if we focus on what happens to quantum gravity, then we have to also focus on what happens to gravity when we quantize it. We also have to focus on what happens to geometry in quantum gravity. And that's what this is about. So the idea is that, well, we don't really have a background classical space-time on which various other matter fields and various other fields are going to be quantum mechanical. In some sense, from the beginning, everything is quantum mechanical, geometry as well as matter fields. So life begins in one shot, so to say, quantum mechanically. So that is the basic general idea. In this blackboard lunch talk I gave a three-dimensional example from three-dimensional gravity, which happened to be completely soluble. It was three-dimensional gravity coupled to, say, Maxwell fields. And then in that example, what we saw was that one could actually write down a metric operator on a certain Hilbert space of states, and so there's genuine quantum geometry, and one could really study things like fluctuations of light cones or whatever one wanted, whatever other issues that one wanted to raise. And Jenny Strachan also gave a talk in which one saw glimpses, so to say, of quantum geometry. In our case, basically, we had the ground states. And I think we'll see more fully, a more complete picture of quantum geometry in this bunch of talks. So now the basic ideas I just want to say are the following. Within this whole approach are the following. The first idea was to sort of find appropriate variables. And this is an idea which I think is common in string theory because of various dualities, for example, that the structure of the theory in one regime may become more transparent in terms of some variables than in another regime that we might be actually familiar with. Okay. So to me, sort of just as a side remark, I mean, when I was thinking about these things, I was quite motivated by superconductivity, where again, once one isolates Cooper pairs as being the basic variables, the Hamiltonian simplifies, and so the question is, can we do similar things up here? And there is concrete evidence, also from duality, but also from 2 plus 1 gravity, for example. Gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions. This theory had been looked at perturbatively using metric and corrections to the metric, so to say the spin 2 fields, if you like, on flat metric, and looking at it perturbatively. And people had very respectable field theories have written papers saying that the theory is not renormalizable and has all the same problems, looking at power counting and so on, that 3 plus 1 dimensional theory has. Similarly, this problem was looked at in the canonical gravity picture by various people, particularly Mark Hendo, Teitelbaum, and other people, and they again concluded that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in this formulation looks as complicated to solve as, almost as complicated as in the full picture. But then we learned from Arturo and Townsend, and then Witten, that in fact this, if we forget about the emphasis on the metric, G mean U, but rather put emphasis on connections, and in the picture that Townsend, Arturo, and Ed Witten had, this was really a connection in a Chern-Simons theory, then the theory was completely soluble. To make contact more directly with what happened in geometrodynamics of Hendo, Teitelbaum, and others, we can also look at this theory as a BF theory. This, in fact, is the first example of a BF theory, because here the action could be really written as the action can be written as a, in this case, B is really a one form, and so the action. About writing in a second. It was invented by Gary. So in this case, the action can be just written as E wedge F. F is the. I understand that the audience is quite diverse, so please do stop me. And sometimes just one little clarification makes a big difference. So the action here is just given as E wedge F, basically. And if you're in higher dimension, this is three dimensions, these are two forms, therefore this is a one form. If you're in higher dimensions, say D dimensions, then F is always a two form. So you would need here a field which takes values in the dual of the Lie algebra, but which is a D minus 2 form, so that you can integrate out. So that field is called D in general. And so one can look at it in this BF theory point of view, and then one sees that the structure of constraints is really much simpler, and one can actually solve this theory. And then, at least in the case when the two space topology is that of a torus, this problem was also solved in geometrodynamics by Vince, and Karlief has, for example, related all these formulations. So there are examples in which dynamics can become more transparent, one way of doing things. It's not that the other variables are quote-unquote wrong, but it's just that they are not so convenient to use. The second viewpoint up here is that is to use non-perturbative methods. So the idea is that we do not use a background space-time and write the full metric as a background metric plus a correction, but we deal with the full metric as such. And for technical reasons, the only way that, when this first started 10 years ago, 12 years ago, the only way that people knew, we knew how to make progress, technical progress in this case, was using the canonical quantization method, and therefore these non-permittivity methods, the only ones we knew, were in the context of canonical quantization, and so the initial work at least has been in the framework of canonical quantization. But in the last couple of years, there has been a lot of work in the so-called spin-form model, which makes it more in the path integral formulation, this kind of ideas. And again, as I said, we'll have some talks about that. Finally, this is a strategy. The strategy is that, just as in general relativity, we first try to understand the geometry, the gravitational field, if you like. We sort of have differential geometry, and we look at gravitational field. We formulate it in terms of differential geometry. And then, once we understand geometry, once we understand gravity, then we couple matter. So the strategy here is very similar. So it's almost opposite of sort of particle physics kind of strategy, in which one might first want to look at, so to say, have a gravitational background field, and have all the matter fields right away. Here, we look at first quantum gravity or quantum geometry, and once we understand this quantum nature of geometry, then we bring in, the idea is then to bring in the various matter fields and study matter couplings. And the idea is that that we need to understand the nature of quantum geometry to even write down the various matter fields and their couplings. That is the basic for three ideas that drive this field. So here, as I just mentioned, that in classical gravitational theories, not just general relativity, super gravity or higher derivative theory, whatever your favorite theory, what we have is really a Riemannian geometry, a pseudo-Riemannian geometry. And once we have Riemannian geometry, then we can consider physics, we can consider gravity as well as matter fields. And the idea now is that if you want to do quantum gravity, then we should really replace this Riemannian geometry by quantum geometry. So in several ways, you can think of this quantum geometry as being as a basic framework, which is going to replace classical geometry, which will enable us to write down field equations. You need some machinery to even write down various operator equations, and quantum geometry is giving you that framework or background in order to write down that machinery. So these are the basic ideas, and now I want to give you a very rapid 3-minute survey of the development stages in this field. The reason is because, as in many fields, where people have been working for 10 years or so, there is a little bit of going back and forth. And so if one just looks at literature, one sometimes gets confused as to some ideas have become obsolete and why are, those, you might see these ideas in some older papers, and then it might become a little confusing. So basically, there have been three phases in the development. The first phase was roughly from 86 to 90. And in this phase, what happens was precisely these appropriate variables were found to do these non-perturbative quantizations for general relativity as well as for supergravity. I think the first paper on supergravity was written by Ted Jacobson, here, up here. And so there was a shift of emphasis from metrics to connections. So the idea is that rather than writing down wave functions of metrics, we are now writing down wave functions of connections on the three-dimensional manifold up here. Then there's a very simple models were worked out, and these involve some mini superspaces, Bianchi models, for example. Some mini superspaces also, but simple ones. Some mini superspaces, and then also linearized gravity, so spin 2 gravity, right? And 2 plus 1 gravity was worked out in this particular framework. And then there was a realization due to Rovelli and Smolin that there is another way, another representation, another way to look at this quantum states, And the idea that they came up with was that we should look at wave functions as functions of loops. These are loops. Closed loops up here. And the idea was that somehow there should be a transform. And this transform should start with functions of connections. And you should be able to integrate out on all the spaces of connection, with respect to connections, which is on the space of connections. And so this is the integrating kernel, which interpolates between connections and loops, is of course the Wilson loop function that traces the holonomy. So this was the idea that one might be able to do such a transform. And then there was a lot of work in this loop representation in about particularly about quantum dynamics. That this suggested relation to knot theory, which by the way has recently there are a lot of results that Jorge Pullin will tell us about the relation between knot theory and solutions to the constraint equations in quantum general relativity. But as time went on, it sort of became clear that this was really a formal transform, and so one got more and more worried that in fact maybe doing all these calculations, one was doing some formal manipulations, and therefore one might be actually putting all the infinities under the rug, and in these formal manipulations, and the reason why everything looks nice and fine is because one just is not careful enough. And in fact, I remember in Kyoto Conference in 1991, several people, certainly me, but so many other people raised this point, but David, they raised this point very strongly, saying, where are the infinities and what is happening? And so this phase really ended about 1990, and from 91 up to about 96, there was another phase in which one tried to develop the mathematical tools more carefully, precisely to worry about these issues about making sure, do we really have well-defined operators? Do we really have well-defined operators when we write down various, when we multiply operators at a point, are we just forgetting some infinities, or have they been properly regularized, are they really self-adjoint, etc.
What is it that you did decide, or various people decided was wrong with the first approach, that you were not addressing
This measure, right, because this measure is very formal, right? This is just a formal integration. This is an integration on infinity dimensional space.
You're not setting up the space properly and defining it properly.
Both of those things.
But you do that in field theory all the time, right?
Right, but then in field theory, in quantum gravity, when you do that, one did that first, and one found that there are all these infinities, and therefore one stopped doing perturbation theory here. So the standard way that we have, which is to give meaning to these heuristic integrals in terms of perturbation theory, is just not available in quantum gravity because the theory doesn't make sense. There's a fundamental.
There's a theory there called perturbation theory, which we have to give infinity, and lattization, which we
know.
So there is a way of making sense out of it.
As approximation, we're not doing the whole thing.
Exactly.
But start by making approximation. A lot of approximation.
Right.
And so you define the infinity procedure. And work.
The question is, as I say, mathematicians still.
Sorry?
Maybe that's
still
there
are.
There's an extremely nice book.
There are even mathematicians who prove some of those manipulations, but exist in quantum field theory. Normalizable quantum field theory has a process of limiting, proof, existence proof.
In K plus 1?
Yeah. Okay. Or as that would be free. Sure. Even QCD.
Okay, I think.
The problem is for DA in this case, these things aren't available.
Sure. Right. And the suspicion has always been that since those are exactly examples where look very much like quantum field theories for which there are equally rigorous mathematical results that the theories don't exist because they're not known.
I think I broadly completely agree with what David is saying, but I would not use the same words. When we compare the words and the content, we'll agree. But I may not use the same words up here. But this is, you probably got a copy too. I just got last week a copy of this quantum field theory conference, right, that we all were in Boston by Cal. I think I can loan it to you. That's a good book in the sense that it really outlines the viewpoints. David speaks of several times. Tom is there. And they're all there. I find it very useful because people's comments sometimes tell you much more than a formal talk. So okay. So now this was the development of this mathematical tools up here. And so what was done was precisely, as Jim already gave me the opening line, was really to understand what this space is, and then what these measures are, or what this measure is in this particular loop transform that one might write down, and then furthermore, what the on this space, the appropriate space, let me just call it A bar, just to say that this is not naive space of connections, but some other space of connections. Not appropriate space, we have calculus, we have functional calculus. So both integral calculus and differential calculus. And for those who sort of have seen various papers and so on, things like spin networks play a very important role. All these things will become more clear as we go along. Spin networks play an important role on all this. And so these mathematical tools were developed up here. And these tools then led to, so to say, this what we now call quantum geometry. That is to say, quantum geometry operators and their studies. And here are self-adjoint operators, which are really self-adjoint operators on Hilbert spaces, so you can actually look at their spectra, etc., etc. And then now, this is a phase.
Does that then make sense of that?
Yeah. So in particular, this integral now it makes sense of this integral, but still on this side, on the space of connections, there is a measure, there is a space, etc. We know how to write down the integral, and we know what the inner product is, etc. We do not have direct control on the space of loops. And there is, of course, induced inner product, because you can always go say, where did it come from? But that is very inconvenient. And therefore, the emphasis has shifted. And in fact, now more and more, implicitly or explicitly, one works in the space of connections. But because of this loop transform, this word has come into the literature, which is called loop quantum gravity, that you will see many often. And it really goes back to this particular thing. However, I should say that I'm going to really not use the loop representation at all, and we're mainly going to talk about this connection representation. These ideas were very influential in actually developing this formulation, but as it often happens, after the finished picture leads us to look at the subject slightly differently than what the motivation led us to look at. Okay.
Is this sufficient to connect single loop, or could you imagine having functional
arbitrary
number of
loops? Right.
So, if I want to construct psi of A, then
right. So the statement is that, single loops are actually enough in this case. Maybe it will become clear as I go along, but single loops are actually enough in this case because for general, if you're looking at SUN as a group, in this case, the gauge group is going to be SU2.
For large N, I could imagine.
No, but just finite N, but not. Right? For SUN, you need actually not just one loop, but you need N minus one loops. But for SU2, which is what is going to be the mostly thing, one loop actually suffices.
Are the loops, they're just giving you the holonomy of the connection, aren't they?
Loops are physical loops. They are used to construct the holonomy of the connection, and this is the holonomy of the connection.
So I did that for representation. I think your answer was about the representation.
Yeah.
No. I mean, with the principle, I can have a correlation function of those observable loops. I have a function of gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma
3. Right, but you could compute those, because the statement is...
Is also expressible for a
single one? No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the wave function is a function of one loop. But
the loops are connected?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Oh, that's a question. Are the loops connected? No, loops are connected. In SU2, again, it doesn't really matter. The reason is because if I take the product of holonomy of around one loop...
One here and another one somewhere else.
Right, and one another up here, then the statement is that if I take the trace of the holonomy, that's what I'm this is a number, trace of the holonomy, then there's a thing, which there's a little formula which tells you for SU2, that if I have two loops like that, I just connect it by any loop I wanted. And then the statement is that the product of W alpha and W beta, in this sense, it can be single. Okay.
So after this, the DA is as well defined as it is in path integral and quantum field theory?
No, it's much better defined. Right, exactly. So the statement, this is a regular Borel measure, which is diffeomorphism invariant, blah, 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 blah. So it is Okay. And now, from now on, so 97 onwards, the work has been on applications of this formulation, and the most notable application has been to black hole entropy and black hole thermodynamics, and extensions. And this, again, these extensions have to do with, as I already mentioned, spin foam models. I think Kirill has already agreed to give a talk on this spin foam model. Then there are things called weave states. This is work in progress now, which are supposed to represent semi-classical geometries, right? I mean, we have some classical geometries, then these are semi-classical states which represent the geometries, and one can imagine doing quantum field theory, for example, Young-Hills theory, on these weave states. So quantum field theory on quantum space-times. So this work is still in the preliminary stages. I mean, some work has been done, but there are no great results up here, whereas for spin foam, there are already some results that are available. So let me just conclude this introduction by just saying that there are a couple of things. There are a lot of people here in string theory, so let me just point out some apparent some similarities which stand out, so to say, and some differences. So the similarities with string theory are that because of the use of connections and because of the use of these loops or graphs or lattices, as we'll do in a second, because of that, because of the similarities, we've got one-dimensional objects, which are basic. And secondly, there are Young-Mills-like variables. These connections are Young-Mills-like variables, which are also coming in to string theory up here. And the big differences from string theory are really that we don't have to be in higher dimensions. So far, in fact, the work is done primarily in four dimensions. Supersymmetry can be included, but it's not necessary. So far, I mean, maybe one day we'll discover that it is necessary for some reason, but so far it's not necessary, and there's no background geometry. Okay. Yeah.
So are you at the point where you can calculate graviton scattering?
No, we're not at a point where we can calculate graviton scattering. That really has to do with these weave states that are going on in this model.
Where do you put in, say, Einstein's theory?
We'll see in a second. Right, so you put Einstein's theory because you formulate quantum Einstein's equations using this quantum geometry. You could formulate supergravity equations if you wanted, but when it's formulating...
Nothing
so
up there, that's just...
That's right. It's really, I should say the most important for it, big application here was precisely quantum Einstein's equations. There's a lot of work on quantum Einstein's equations up here. Okay. The original framework was really done four dimensions. So I don't know, three or four dimensions. It was just straightforward, it works in straightforward way in three or four dimensions. But more recently, there has been, again, this extension to higher dimensions, but this is much more recent, so we don't know how far all these are. The rigorous work can be extended in that case. Okay, so now let me begin with the first thing. It's a long introduction, and the first thing has to do with just telling you what the basic variables are up here. So I'm now in this connection dynamics picture up here. And so our basic variables are going to be the following. This is four space-time dimensions, and we are going to assume in a minute, not at this stage, but in a minute, that the space-time manifold is really some three-dimensional manifold times R, so it has this topology, because we're going to use canonical methods, so Hamiltonian methods. So basic variable is a one-form, a sort of cotetra.
What we should just think about, keep this in the back of our minds.
That's keep it in the back of our minds. The classical theory, I need that, right? I mean, on the classical theory, I would need...
Your first statement was always quantum.
Right. So, thank you. Okay. So what is happening up here so far is that the manifold structure is still remaining classical. What is quantum from the beginning is geometry. By geometry, I guess I'm using it in the technical sense of metric or the Riemannian geometry, if you like. That is what is being called quantum.
It's sort of some kind of physics, formula in some kind of topological space.
Exactly. This is formulated in terms of, in fact, a differential manifold that is given to you once a differential manifold, more than slightly. And the second thing is that if you do something like this in the three-dimensional case, right, in the 2+1 dimensional gravity, then at the end of the day, one can actually formulate everything in terms of just combinatorially, so that you never have to use in the final picture, although in the beginning you got that. So the final picture is completely combinatorial. And from that combinatorial description, you know, so sort of a smart student can deduce that there's the topology really in this case, that one is talking about a topology which has such and such, you know, which is a torus with, or a sphere with n handles. And but the final picture could be just done combinatorial. So one of the ideas of theory is that finally using knot theory will enable us to do similar things here, but we're very far from that. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the statement is that knot theory is so much more complicated, right? In 4 dimensions, the knots are reduced in 3 dimensions with homotopy classes, and that is such a simple spaces. I mean, we don't know classification of knots in 4-dimensional gravity, that is to say 3-dimensional space. And that makes life much more complicated in 4-dimensional gravity.
You're not trying to contact the topology.
No, at this stage we're not with topology fixed. Okay, so our basic variables are going to be some co-trials. So this is really one form, and this I is just a, if you like, Minkowski index, 0, 1, 2, 3. This is just a label of this co-trial. E1, E2, E3, E4 are our co-trials up here. Now, if you give yourself a co-trial, as we know, it determines for us a spin connection. And so this spin connection is a Lorentz connection, and therefore it is anti-symmetric in these indices. These are internal indices, if you like. And what we are now going to do is to just consider the self-dual part of that spin connection. Self-dual in this I and J indices up here. Of omega.
Tetra.
I said sorry. Thank you. So it's these are co-tetras, and then they determine for us a certain spin connection, and then this is a self-dual part of the spin connection. So these are going to be, I mean, you think of it as though it is the self-dual part of this spin connection. Okay. In other words, in solutions, it is going to be the case that this A will be the self-dual part of the spin connection of E. But to begin with, our basic variables are just A's, E's and A's. They're just one forms. This real algebra valued up here, and this is just has an, it's like a Higgs scalar, if you like. It has a Higgs internal index up here. Okay. And our action, this is just Einstein action, up to some numerical factor, is just given by what it's called is just E where G, let me call it a two-form sigma where J, where this two-form sigma is again self-dual part, so sigma ij is just self-dual part of E where G. And here we're contacting the internal indices, or I can say that I got trace of all these internal indices. If there is a boundary, then you just have to add a boundary term. The boundary term is just trace of A with sigma. So then the boundary. From now on, we won't worry about it. Yeah. It does. But the statement is that somehow, even though that's a good question, because it's not obvious that in fact everything will work out, that you will get the full dynamics if you just start emphasizing self-dual connections. But our variable is not just this, it also has, at this stage, it also has this tetrad up here.
And this is the complete Einstein dynamics.
This is the complete Einstein dynamics.
It's manifestly non-parity.
It's manifestly non-parity invariant, right. This formula in the way is non-parity. Yeah.
And how do you see that?
Well, we can just look at the field equations, and then field equations, you can see that there's no problem with parity.
But that's, and I am assured that,
yeah, so,
I'm sure that that's necessarily the case for the theory.
Right, we're not assured, the classical theory, you're assured of that.
Yeah.
The classical level, you're assured of that. You're not assured of that in quantum theory, I'm agreeing with you.
And how do I, is there a way of understanding how I, Is this a gauge for the Drake barrier?
No, I think it's more than that. I think the basic idea comes because the idea is that you should, this is a, I don't want to defend this too strongly, but there's a viewpoint which says that maybe we should base our quantization on exactly integrable sectors of the theory. And the self-dual sector of Einstein's theory is exactly integrable in some sense, which I will later on tell you. And so the idea here is that therefore you try to base, to write, I mean it's a non-transparent thing that one can actually do this, that that Einstein's equation can, the full theory can actually be formulated just using the tetras and just the self-dual part of the connection. Okay. That you actually get full Einstein's equation and not just half of Einstein's equation. So
we certainly have enough to be the
freedom. Yeah, we certainly have enough to be the freedom. There's no question about it. Because we have what is.
Can the same action be derived from starting with the full connection?
If you just do the real part of this thing, then it will give you the full connection, basically. So you'll just add.
There is a section for belting the action, like even belting the action, and adding torsion to it. Any of the adjustments.
So what am I adding?
Torsion terms, meaning.
Yeah.
Like total derivative.
Total derivative.
Yeah, it's just adding total.
So this differs, you're saying, just by total derivatives from first order.
Does
that mean the imaginary part of the action is just
the first thing? So, that's why I was being very careful. I think you said something which is more complicated. Okay, so the statement is the following, right? That if I look at this action as a whole, maybe that is really David's question, not sort of the field equation, and this action as a whole is not... it's not true, okay, that I can take this action and I can do the standard Palazzini action, right? And I can subtract the two. So I'll get something. And the question that maybe is really being asked is that really a total derivative? And the answer is no, that's not a total derivative, okay? However, if the first equation of motion is satisfied on A, okay, then this extra term that we have added automatically vanishes by Bianchi identity. Okay. We're going to get two equations, as I will see in a second. Varying with respect to A, varying with respect to E. If I use the equation I get by varying with respect to A, I use that equation. Okay. Then the extra part of the action I got is identically zero by Bianchi identity. And it's not very profound. What I'm saying is that you're just writing down, right? Let's suppose RABCD plus I star RABCD. And this action up here is basically corresponds to contracting on GAC and GBD. But this is true to begin with. This is really some curvature. Okay. It's not really related to the metric at all or to the time. But if I use the equation of A, then A, that tells me that this A is compatible with E, as I was saying up here. Okay. Then this really becomes just the Riemann. And then we can see that this is identically zero just by Bianchi identity. One of them is identically. Yeah, this is identically zero just by Bianchi identities, basically.
Isn't the action
is parity invariant on shift, exactly. But that's not. And the boundary condition is really the replacement of trace of the extrinsic curvature thing that we normally have.
Where did it have to get complexified? Because it itself to apply.
Yeah.
And you start doing geometry and you don't think you need complex.
Yeah, so this is the starting point to begin with. And then the reason, raise on the egg.
So who's complex value? Everything?
No, this is complex value. This is self-dual in these indices. Therefore, this is complex value. This is real and this is abstract.
Okay.
I get regular tetrad up here. I probably won't get through all this with all these questions. It doesn't matter because I have one more lecture. Yeah, please go ahead.
This can't be done.
You can have FF dual to the angle section and get something which is from.
No, but one can do this in Young Lucid. In fact, Ted pointed out how to do
this.
Okay. Right. So that's the action. And if I vary this action with respect to A, as we were just saying, and set that equal to zero, what that tells me is precisely that A is a self dual part of omega In other words, it tells me that this is a spin connection and this is just the cell dual part of the omega. And then when I vary with respect to E, directly it just tells me something like EI wedge FIJ equal to 0. But now if I use this equation together with this, that is to say I use the fact that this really A is really the self dual part of omega, therefore this R is really the self dual part of the Riemann tensor of E, then that just tells us Einstein's equation is satisfied. So this is just good old Einstein's theory. Okay. Now what I want to do is to... this is really Einstein's theory, just that writing it out in terms of a complex variable. It's like doing the harmonic oscillator in terms of coordinate, which happens to be z, which is q plus ip. And it's really a real harmonic oscillator, but I happen to... So in the phase space and the field space, I just have to use some complex coordinate. Okay. Now, the second part is to go to the make the Lagrangian transform and say what happens to the Hamiltonian framework. So when I do the Lagrangian transform, go to the Hamiltonian framework, I'm going to get canonical variables. And this actually is really nice. I mean, you can do the Lagrangian transform like in four lines up here because of all the forms and everything. And not very surprisingly, perhaps, the basic variables are going to be, well, I got this four-dimensional connection for a minute. Let me just write with the four up here. That was a connection sitting up there. And you just pull it back to three-dimensional manifold. This is what we always do in Young-Mills shape something. We just restrict it to three-dimensional manifold. And now on, let me call this A. So this A is a 3D connection. And then I got here, similarly, I got this sigma, which was a self-dual thing, self-dual part of E by G. This is sigma up here. And I can just pull back this sigma on these indices up here. And what I obtain is so this is a four-dimensional object. So I just obtain some three-dimensional, this is three-dimensional two form. But in three dimensions, we all know that all two forms are dual to vector densities. So I can just take and just dualize where this eta is just a Levi-Civita, so it does not use a metric. There's no background metric up here, just using the Levi-Civita, which always exists. So this object, therefore, is going to be a Lie algebra valued vector density. So our basic variables are going to be connection and what looks like an electric field, which is Lie algebra valued vector density. Even in Young-Mills theory, the electric field always comes as a Lie algebra valued vector density, and it's only because we've got a background metric, we write it as an electric field. In other words, we just use the determinant of the background metric to kill off the density vector. So that is the basic idea up here. And the only last... Now, these are canonical to each other, and I'll just write down the relations. And the last thing is that, over here, the Lie algebra in which A took values was, or if sigma ij and F took values, if you like, is always a self-dual Lie algebra, self-dual part of the Lorentz group. Okay. But if you give me a three-dimensional surface, right, and I got a time-like vector field up here, which is unit normal to that, so that's what we're doing now in a canonical thing, then there's a natural isomorphism between the three-dimensional self-dual Lie algebra and the Lie algebra rotations around this point. Right? And you can just write down this isomorphism once and for all. I mean, like some symbol I is typically what is used for this isomorphism, I times ij. And the idea is that if you take a connection, for example, then out comes something which is just in the Lie algebra index now is in the SO3 up here, associated with this particular surface. So from now on, I'm going to think of this A and E as vector density and a connection one form, which takes values in the Lie algebra of SO3. At the Lie algebra level, it is also just SU2. If you have spinner fields, really SO3 is genuinely replaced by SU2. Because from the beginning, I have to go to the double covering up here. So that's what we have. And these are real. These are density values. And these are complex. the complex one falls to stake value is the Lie-Alger of S2, if you like. That's what it's like. Okay. Now, what is the geometrical meaning of these objects? Well, the geometrical meaning of E. There are actually six independent ones, but let me just... Right, which we'll see in a second how that happens. Just 1 second. So geometrical meaning of these things. So E up here is really what you might expect it to be. It's like a triad, but it's the only density vector triad. That is to say, if I take this E, right, this is just equal to the square root of the 3 metric. In all this work, the 3 metric is always written like as QAB. This is the 3 metric. And it's, the word Q is used because it's like in geometry dynamics, it was a configuration or coordinate variable. So I'll just write down Q up here. Times a triad now. This is orthonormal triad. So what I'm trying to say is that you can think of this E as being density determined by metric density times an orthonormal triad. That's what this is. Now I come to David's question. If I look at this A looks like you work out what it is. Now if you give me this E or this E in three dimensions, I got a triad, therefore there's a spin connection. This E or this capital E, that they determine a spin connection. So it's like this index structure up here. Right? I mean, it's just a connection which operates on internal SO3 or SO2 indices up here. That is given to us. And what A is that it's equal to this minus I times the extrinsic curvature. So this is just the extrinsic curvature of the metric. This is the square root of the 3 metric, if you like, and this is the extrinsic curvature. Now, extrinsic curvature normally we write as KAB, and all that is happening up here is that we are converting the internal index into space index into an internal index and writing it as KI. So now the point up here is that you see, these objects are already determined by E. Therefore, the non-trivial information in the momentum is just this information that we have out here. So even though it is complex, really the momentum part, so to say, is really all in K up here. More precisely, if I looked at usual geometry dynamics in terms of spectra, R0, that's exactly right, E and gamma are 0, so the points are bracket here. So in the usual geometry dynamics in terms of triads, everything is real. And what we know is that E with K, the reason I'm going into all these details is because of some people who want to really understand this point. And so they told me so. Thanks, KBJ. So this is just given by delta AB, delta IJ, and delta KX. Why? Okay. This is what happens in ordinary geometry dynamics. You've got the triad, which is like the square root of the metric, and the extrinsic curvature. This really is extrinsic curvature, not the momentum, because the density weights, it turns out that this is exactly the extrinsic curvature. So this is the normal Poisson bracket that we have in geometry dynamics. Now the Poisson bracket that we have turns out to be equal to EI times ABJ is equal to delta AD, delta IJ, delta KXY. Except that because of this historical way that this connection was defined with an I here rather than I here, there's an I in the Poisson bracket up here. And finally, if I'm really careful and put all the dimensions right, then I find that there's a Newton's constant sitting up here and there's a Newton's constant sitting up here.
But these are the facts.
These are the facts. So now, so this is just to help connect it with the usual vector. And now, what about Einstein's equations? If I look at Einstein's equation, they simplify significantly here. And I just want to take a minute to say a word about it, because when Jorge Pullin gives a fourth lecture, he is going to be looking at these Einstein's equations and to see what their quantum analog is going to be. And also, this remark might be useful to people in computational physics up here. So let me just make this remark. So the Einstein's equations, so there are constraint equations, and the constraint equations just look like dAf eAi equal to 0. So this is exactly the Gauss constraint equation, which tells us, which enforces gauge invariance.
D is a spatial derivative.
Yeah, everything is spatial now because we're in the Hamiltonian framework, so everything is spatial. So we get this, and then this is the vector, this is the Gauss constraint. Then the usual Fermi-Wave constraints of general relativity look like BAI times FA BI equal to 0. So just if you like, it, you can think of F as being B, if you like, for a the dual of F is just the magnetic field D. And this equation just says that E cross, it says the trace of E cross B equal to 0. And then finally, we have a third equation, which is epsilon I jk, EI, EBJ, FADK, equal to 0. And this is a scalar constraint equation. So let me give names. This is the Gauss constraint, this is the vector or the diffeomorphism constraint, and this is a scalar constraint equation. So these are just names, these are just definitions, and this is the thing that normally gives rise to the V-relativity equation. And the nice thing up here is that all these equations look like Yang-Mills. This is completely Yang-Mills. This is just some conditions, obviously, like the Yang-Mills field that you may have. If you think of E as the electric field and A as a connection, therefore B as a magnetic field, this is just saying trace of E cross B equal to 0, and this is saying trace of E dot E cross B equal to 0. Okay. And now the total Hamiltonian, as in always the case in general relativity, is just given by linear combination of constraints, so you just get d3x times Lagrange multipliers for the internal rotations, for the vector fields, so this is the shift, and lattice. And in the asymptotically flat or asymptotically anti-de Sitter context, there are surface terms which are non-zero up here. So the thing is that these equations are all, these C's are all polynomial, low-order polynomials in your basic variables, and therefore the equations of motion, the time evolution equations, which I won't write down, they're also low-order polynomials. And what Oscar Ruella and two of his colleagues have shown is that this system of equations, as it stands, is first-order symmetric hyperbolic. And I, again, this is a side remark for numerical relativity, that I know that, you know, people use some codes and they're very used to those codes, and it's a big challenge to change the code and all that, and that is why nobody's pushing this way of doing numerical relativity very much. However, I think that it's probably true that this is just a conjecture, but it's a slightly educated conjecture. There's some work that Gary and I had done some time ago, which showed how to use a Witten equation, which is used in the context of positive energy conjecture, positive energy theorem, to draw lattice and shift fields from infinity to inside. There is a prescription that we gave. And I think it's likely that if you couple that prescription will fit in very nicely with this time evolution equation. Again, there are some reasons to believe that prescription might be really useful for numerical relativity, for these black hole problems having to do with the boundary conditions of the horizon, etc. And so, just sort of side remark, is that it is possible that this thing might actually be very useful in the context of numerical relativity, particularly the black hole collision problem.
Complex.
Yeah.
These are to be regarded as twice as many equations, or
yes, I think even if you, yeah, so
the structure of A automatically is consistent with the equation.
Right.
Assume
yeah. And then it's automatically consistent with the equation.
You don't want to write the equation in this nice form, you want to.
So if you do, yeah, if you rewrite them, then they just become the standard alien equations. The Arnold
Wittgenstein. Well, when you discuss these equations as they stand without rewriting them, are they, you have twice as many equations because they're complex?
Yeah, to begin with, there are twice as many equations, right, but some of them can be eliminated. That is what you're sort of getting at. And so, but once you eliminate them, there are the same number of equations as in the standard formulation.
But is that unique? Solution? I mean,
sorry, say it again.
Is that
Yeah, solutions are unique.
The Kreisman equation, you say, always all solutions reduce to the solutions of the...
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Right.
So is there, I mean, in addition to these equations, some extra, I guess we used to call the reality condition?
Right. So, but the way that I've presented the matter, A is from the beginning real and A is given by gamma plus I. I mean, the reality condition is just this. Says that...
One needs to know that.
Right. But his question was really that if initially this is satisfied, is it satisfied everywhere? And the answer
I should think of those equations plus the reality condition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I remember 5-10 years ago there was some discussion of solving the constraints and that it was easy in some cases, but you had to have something non-degenerate. Has that program ever been completed?
Well, I think there was some work of Ted and Capovilla and Jacobson, Del, Capovilla and Jacobson, about this, in which, you know, what the idea is that these equations could be solved by giving algebraic answers, and then one has to still solve this equation up here, which you still have to do it. And I don't know if, for example, for numerical relativity is useful or not. I mean, I think there's a gap here between...
If you impose the reality condition,
No. So the statement is that you can impose the reality conditions, I gave them in the sort of the most transparent form, directly in terms of A's and sigmas. I can write them down if you like, but you can impose the reality conditions. And the statement is that that reality condition is preserved in time. If the data is preserved in time, the data. So this was just to say it explicitly, if you like. I mean, for numerical relativity, this doesn't matter, because one can just say that at time t equals 0, you can even begin with the ADM data and write it in this form. And then just use these equations in order to evolve them. But numerical relativity doesn't really matter. But as far as quantum gravity is concerned, I'm going to make one more step, which I don't know if I'll get to that today or the first thing that I'll do next time, in which, in fact, we are going to be able to consider real connections. This was just to sort of tell you how one gets going. The reason is because we really do not have a good understanding of how to begin with the real connections, stay with the real connections. We only know how to do it by first then making this form, this particular formulation, and then making another canonical transformation. So in a while, we're going to use some other variables which are going to be manifestly real, and all these issues will not arise anymore.
Right. From this viewpoint, from the usual case, you've got the bracket of E with K, and the only difference between that and the other is you've got just a complex linear shift. But it's a particular one, so if I forgot about everything else and just made an arbitrary complex linear shift, what happens? I mean, there must be something that...
Right. So the statement is that the thing that you have to check, the non-trivial thing here you have to check, is the Poisson bracket of A with A equals 0. That is a non-trivial thing that you have to check.
Okay.
And now that is what gives conditions...
So if I put a coefficient in front of gamma, that will only vanish if that coefficient is unity. Right?
Oh, you mean just a number up here?
Yeah.
No, I think number will be okay. There'll be no problem with the number.
Yeah.
But I thought you meant you just put some other function up here.
Well, more generally some other function.
No, coefficient is okay. I think that thing will go through with the coefficient. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think I'm going that out of the hole.
Was asking whether that was in any sense complete.
Okay, that's what. So the statement was that these constraints could be solved just algebraically, but one has to put this back and then get one constraint up here, which is now the constraint. This particular matrix that you have to use, that matrix comes up here, and then you have to solve that particular constraint. I do not know. I stopped in the middle. I do not know if, in fact, that is something that is easy numerically, that is something hard numerically, etc. I really don't know. There is a sort of a gap between people who do numerical work and people who do these things. And so, etc. Okay. So now, let me just start with this mathematical tools. Maybe there's a remark or two. Oh, there's just one remark that I wanted to make. Unfortunately, the things are erased from the board, which are here, I think. Then I wrote down the action as E and A to be equal to the integral of sigma major, where sigma was just a function of E. Okay? I wrote down the action of trace of sigma. Sigma is a function of E. It is a self-dual part of E by E. That is what sigma was. But there is a way to look at this whole action, which is now being used, particularly in the spin foam models, in which we can drop this constraint and think of this really as an action which just involves two forms sigma. And then the condition, which said that sigma was self-dual path of E by G, that condition can be just put in here by Lagrange multiplier. Some Lagrange multiplier psi ij times sigma I by sigma j. So the statement, these are Lagrange multipliers. So the statement is that there is some algebraic condition on sigma which guarantees that sigma is a self-dual part of E by G for some non-degenerate E's. And quite often, so this is really now, without this condition, it really is a BF theory or sigma F theory in this case. And now this is often thought of as a constraint BF theory. And this will be used in many of the formulations. I didn't completely tell you the conditions up here. The algebraic conditions up here, which I think are, this is symmetric and trace free. Now where you do the variations with respect to, so this now depends on this and the Lagrange multiplier by psi. When I do the variation with respect to psi, it tells me that symmetric trace-free part of sigma ij is equal to zero, and that so, and that is that tells us that sigma is in fact sort of essentially simple, not it's self-dual part, simple.
F is already projected onto the self-dual part.
So we don't need to make. No, I agree. It just right. It says that F is that, so you don't have to take the self-dual part yet. That's what your question was, right? So it's just that in order to do the Hamiltonian formulation, I wanted the self-dual part because it's right. Okay, so this is really the end of the end of this part up here, and now let me just can I go on for one more topic? I won't do the fourth one, but I can just go on for, okay. This is about the mathematical tools. This is now, I'm making a shared headache before. Okay. So, now, I mean, if I had done the fourth part, you would have seen how all these things come together. But in the third part, think of this as just a side that I'm really trying to do. Some mathematical tools which are going to be useful for quantization. And we'll see why it is useful for quantization next time around. Okay. So we got this. The idea up here is that we want to consider wave functions psi of A, and these wave functions are supposed to be. Now what we need integral calculus and we need differential calculus on the space of A's. So these are functions on the space of connections, and we need integral and differential calculus. Why do we need integral calculus? Because we want to define, for example, the inner product to be psi bar psi. So I need to be able to integrate on the space of all connections. This is the space of all connections up here. And similarly, I need differential calculus because I need operators. For example, in quantum mechanics, we have operators like Laplacians or derivative operators. So we need to have suitably defined vector fields and Laplacians and such things on this space. At the moment, this is just completely vague, so it doesn't really matter at this integral remark. I'll make it clear in 1 second. So now, I would like to consider. So, what is the idea? The basic idea is that consider. This is the basic idea. We want to consider the space of A. This is the space of connections. Not gauge removed, but just space of connections. You can do either way. I happen to do it this way because it is quicker. Okay. We can just consider space of connections up here on P manifold. On P manifold. Let me say compact at the moment because if there is a boundary, I would like to. Exactly what you said. I'll just specify a few more things, which we understand now, but just for time, I'll just say supposing it's compact. And these are, and these connections are supposed to be taking values from structure group G, which is compact. In our case, ultimately when we are done, when I've done the fourth step, the G will turn out to be SU2. So we're just going to be looking at SU2 connections basically. Now the idea is that we want to consider some wave functions. So we go back and say, well, what is sort of the raison d'etre of a connection, right? I mean, why does a connection want to exist? Well, it wants to exist because it gives rise to holonomies, and that is what the connections are supposed to do, right? I mean, so if you look at these wave functions, it is natural to consider these wave functions, which are built out of these holonomies. And then if you wanted gauge invariants, then you will just consider holonomies along closed paths, for example, which will be traces, and they'll be automatically gauge invariant. So the idea, but now we want to consider this calculus. I'm just talking about this part first. I want to do this without introducing a background metric. So the basic idea is just the following. That given any connection, this regular all smooth connection, it gives us a mapping if you give me an edge in this physical space-time. So it assigns to each edge some group element. Let me call it H sub E. This is just the holonomy along that is defined by a connection from one point to another point. An edge is always is closed and has two endpoints up here.
So it's
not really,
E isn't
infinitesimal? No, it's finite. It's fine. So this really is a holonomy. So I just do path.
Is it a
path? Path order. So this is just.
Why do you call it a path?
I mean, sometimes accidentally has been called, but for the reason is, as you said in a second. So now, the idea is that we want to now define certain kinds of wave functions, and then we want to define the product on them. The kinds of wave functions, the idea basic is, did you consider a graph, mathematical literature graph, physical literature, a floating lattice? Lattice which is not necessarily regular, because we don't know what regular means, it's just a manifold. So we might have some lattice like that, for example, one edge may be even knotted. Okay, so I got some lattice like that. Okay. This is an edge, which is goes around, helps, makes a knot. This is just an edge. It's a graph, right? And a graph which happens to one edge happens to be marked. And just to make the point that this is not rectangular. It's not a deep point. okay.
So this is just a collection of paths.
This is just a collection of paths such that, you know, it's a graph in the sense that they meet at only endpoints and such like that.
But every time they intersect,
every time it's inside. So this is one path, this is another path, this is another path, then this whole thing is another path, and this is another path. So we get some, so this is a graph or floating lattice, and we can call this gamma. Okay. And now what we want to do is the following. What do we do normally in gauge theory, lattice gauge theory? Well, if you give it a lattice like that, with each of these edges, I got E1, E2, E3, etc., EN edges. So this connection comes and assigns to each of these edges a holonomy, an edge up here. So every connection, so to say, the space of connections is an infinitely dimensional space. So therefore, if I want to coordinateize it, I need infinitely many coordinates. And given a graph, what it does is to extract out of the infinite dimensions information just a finite number of pieces of information. That's what the graph. And now the idea is that, first of all, look at wave functions which only depend on this finite number of pieces. So the idea is that we look at this wave function psi. So first of all, fix any function, a complex valued function, little psi, on n copies of the group. Okay? And now I take little psi, if you give me n group elements, this little psi gives me a number, right? And so now I'm going to define for you a wave function of the connection. And the idea is that you take this connection, you go to this edge. This connection assigns it to a holonomy. So this is just the holonomy assigned by the connection to E1, up to E1. So what we've done is we've distributed the tasks. The connection comes, and no, they're the holonomies, they're not traces. They're copies of the group. So we've distributed the task. A comes and assigns holonomies up here, and Psi looks at n group elements and uses a number. And then therefore together, I got this.
Any particular order?
No, there's no particular order. I mean, you have fixed the... You fix an order once and for all. I mean, you label these EEs in some order, and then you'll get this thing. And if Jim comes and labels them differently, I mean, there'll be natural isomorphism between the spaces. Okay. So this is the holonomy assigned by it. So it's not a very... So at first this looks very trivial, right? And this looks like, why are we doing this? We're just getting some finite dimensional information out of something which is so non-trivial, which is infinite dimensional information. But if you look at the literature on how functional integrals are rigorously defined, how people define measures, this is exactly what they do. I mean, what do we need? What do we know? We know how to perform integrals on finite dimensional spaces. To perform the integral of infinite dimensional spaces, we perform them on finite dimensional spaces, and then we make sure, we take a limit if you like, or we make sure that there is some consistency. And then that defines a measure on the infinite dimensional spaces. That is the usual idea of defining rigorously measures there, and that's what we're going to do now. So if I have just one lattice like that, or one graph like that, then the space that I will obtain of such functions, of course it is infinite dimensional, right? Because it is functions on G to the N, it is infinite dimensional. But it's very small in infinite dimensional. Right? So this is like quantum mechanics, not quantum field theory at all. But we don't have a preferred graph. So all we have is this manifold. And we consider all possible graphs at the same time. When I consider all possible graphs, I get a huge collection of functions. Absolutely huge collection of functions. Okay? And this space of functions that I obtain is going to lead us to our Hilbert space. So in other words, no, it's not quite direct. You have to take a certain limit because of the problem, right? Supposing I got this graph and I got another graph, which is just this thing. And the two graphs are not independent, so I can't take direct sum. So that is the key caveat that I have to worry about, that I got consistency.
Exactly, so on a lattice, you don't actually take a possible.
We don't do that. So this is a very different way of looking at the continuum theory. I'm completely agreeing with you. This is a very different way of looking at the continuum theory. I'm not done. It's not, so I'll just, and I'm of this, including finite.
Also, I'm not sure.
This is very.
I'm not sure I understand why this so-called graph. Why not just do it on certain family of loops?
You can do it in the family of loops. It's completely equivalent, but it takes more work because there are more linear dependence relations that you have to worry about. In fact, we did first. I was the one who always wanted to do in terms of loops because of the loop representation. First, it was all done in terms of loops. Okay, so we did it all in terms of loops first. But technically, it is actually harder to explain what the construction is because of all sorts of relations that you have to take into account. Well, it just is, I can explain to you later. It has to do with...
Wait, so what is the consistency?
Just one second. So, let me just do this idea first and then tell you the real thing. Just 2 more minutes and the idea is finished. Okay, so what is the idea now? And the idea now is that if you give me a particular graph, right, if you just give me a particular graph psi, gamma, then I can take two such functions, psi and chi. They're both associated with the gamma, and I can define the inner product. And the inner product is just g to the n times Haar measure, normalized Haar measure, okay, times psi times chi. Right? Because I can just think of this as being a function because of this thing. I can think of this as a function of on n copies of the group, and I just do this. This is what one would do in a lattice gauge series. This is for one fixed graph, right, exactly. That's what we do up here. Now, if you have one fixed graph, gamma up here. Now, what we want to do is to allow all possible graphs, and let me just do it first, and then I'll tell you the real thing. And When you want to allow all possible graphs, however, this is a very nice result, not a very profound one, which is that you give me any two graphs, this one and this one, say, then there is a third graph, which is all, which contains both of them. And I just draw some edges like that, contains both of them. Yeah, but there is at least one. I mean, there's always a bigger graph. There are many such graphs, absolutely right. Therefore, I can consider the wave function which is associated with the first graph. I can also consider it associated with a bigger graph, which happens not to depend on these particular holonomies. And similarly, the wave function associated with the second graph, I can think of it as being associated with the whole graph, which doesn't depend on these holonomies. And therefore, if I know how to do this in a product, okay, on all possible, on any one graph, on any graph, any one graph, I know this in a product.
I don't understand that doesn't depend on the...
Okay, because... I'm not questioning it.
You just say if you know it on a graph, you know it on all the subgraphs.
Yeah.
Disconnected as well.
We can consider disconnect all. I can connect them, but then I got some holonomy. I mean, this graph has n, n1, but this graph has n2, and the total graph has n, which is n1 plus n2 plus something, and a function on the first graph is a, in particular, function on the bigger graph, but doesn't happen to, happens not to depend on a few other holonomies. Just, yeah, it's just a forgetful function.
So
if
you're
like.
Just allowing for bigger graphs.
We're just allowing bigger graphs. There's no...
Or
you can connect them if you like. I mean, this is a technical issue. I mean, it doesn't make any difference. You can just connect them. Okay. So, and now, so we got this thing, and now we will take Cauchy completion of this space. And that is going to be our fiducial Hilbert space, H. So, the dense of space is obtained by these simple functions, which, by the way, are called cylindrical functions. This is just a major theoretical terminology. The cylindrical functions depend only on a finite number of variables, so to say. It has only finite number of information, and then we take this completion. So the last thing I want to do is to tell you what the real stuff is. And this is the idea. It's not wrong, but I still want to tell you some caveats as to where the problems are, because it looks like otherwise everything looks too trivial, too simple. No, it's not the same thing as continuum limit in the usual sense of the word. Say it again.
Even for on a compact manifold, the number of edges is not bounded.
The number of edges here for any one graph is bounded, right?
I mean, no, but the number of edges when you in order to do the completion is unbounded.
Right.
So this is different than a lattice until you take the limit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And now the whole problem is exactly about this, namely that this is illusion. I mean. This to say that I just take the Cauchy completion and I've done everything. You see, it's providing one continuum limit, and I have to tell you how this continuum limit is taken. Just 1 second. Okay. The reason is because we are normally used to quantum mechanics. You see, in quantum mechanics, we can consider smooth function of compact support or something, and you take the Cauchy completion and we get L2 function. And we say, well, I mean, you know, it's just a small thing, few limit points are added. But as far as quantum field theory is concerned, that's not the case. This completion is extremely non-trivial as soon as the infinite number of degrees of freedom. In particular, when you're taking this Cauchy completion, it is no longer true that elements of this Hilbert space are not anymore functions of connections. They're more general objects, if you like. You can't represent them as functions of connections. So what exactly is happening? What are we doing up here? I mean, this is a poor man's way of doing it. And so what is happening? So now that's my last point. Okay, so what is happening is the following. That A, the space of smooth connections, is a class.
You have many more. I mean, this is over completely.
That's exactly what is going to be reduced now. And this over-completeness is exactly, I mean, one of the key points is going to be addressed here, because otherwise, this over-completeness is what will cause inconsistencies. And somebody asked me, what are the consistency conditions? So we'll see what is happening up here. Okay. So this is a classical configuration space. But typically, when you go to quantum field theory, the wave functions don't want to live on the classical configuration space. Wave functions want to live on some space of distributions, some bigger space up here. Okay, much bigger space. Not only that, but typically the measure which exists on this bigger space, if you try to see what is the measure of the smooth configurations, it is typically zero. So in some sense, when one really measure theoretically, when this space does not have too much information. It does have information in topologically, but not measured theoretically. Okay, so let me just say what we are going to do up here. So what happens is that this whole structure is leading us from the space of classical configurations to, let me call it A bar, this is the space of, let me call it quantum configuration space. And this is a well-defined space, and I want to tell you about this space. And the wave functions, which are Cauchy completion, in the Cauchy completion, are genuine wave functions on this space. And finally, this Hilbert space that I am constructing is in fact an L2 space, a square integrable functions on this space with respect to a real measure, with respect to a Borel regular measure. So that is what is going to happen.
Genuine wave function, what did you mean?
No, genuine measure.
No,
I just meant genuine. Sorry, okay. So the wave functions are genuine functions. I mean, states, quantum states, are genuine functions on this space. They are not some generalized objects anymore. Okay, that is what is happening. Okay, so let me...
What? Are you going to discuss it now?
Oh, 1 minute or... No, maybe I should stop. Okay, I should stop.
No.
I should tell it. Good, thank you. Good. Because it will take only a few minutes, I hope. It's like the farmer's last year, right? Okay, so what is this space up here? So it's very simple space, actually, the state, so let me just say it. So generalized connection, what it does is the following. An ordinary connection is a really Lie algebra valued one form, smooth and such thing. What a generalized connection is, it's not a Lie algebra valued one form. It's sort of, but rather what it does is, it assigns to every edge a group element. It's a mapping which does that, subject to two conditions. The first condition is that, so these are all always directed edges, oriented edges. Otherwise I won't get group element. I mean, if you go the other way around, I'll get the inverse. So A bar operates on E minus 1, just gives me A bar of E minus 1. This group element, just call it this way, HE of A bar is equal to right. So if it assigns to this edge a group element, then it assigns the opposite group element to this edge. And second is, that if you give me two edges which are composed up here, E1, E2, then the obvious things happen. This group element is just equal to this group. But notice that this condition is purely algebraic. There is no topological condition up here. So this assignment can be very discontinuous. So I can have edge and I can have nearby edge, and these generalized connections can assign them any discontinuous values. Okay. So I take HE1 and I evaluate on A bar, and I take HE2 and evaluate on A bar. So this is a group element, this is a group element. Or I can take HE1, E2. Think of this as a one edge, single edge. E1 composed with E2 and operate on A bar. This is obvious things, and composition and things. This is obvious thing. So for example, I mean, in the non-abelian case, I can give an example, but it will take a little longer. But in the abelian case, I can just consider a distributional connection for which the magnetic field, for example, is concentrated on a surface like that. And if I got an edge which goes up here, the whole holonomy will be trivial. But if I have an edge which passes through the surface, then there's no jump in holonomy because the magnetic field is all distributional up here. So basically, these are going to be distributional connections in some suitable sense, and this is what is taken care of. And now the last thing is it's not yet, because you can easily get rid of edge gauge issues by constructing this A bar and dividing out by appropriate completion of the local gauge group. And there are theorems which say these are the same as you might have started with this space and then done the completion, and these are all equal to each other, and there are all these theorems up here. Okay. So we got this thing A bar up here, And the statement is that this A bar admits a regular diffeomorphism invariant Borel measure, which you call d mu bar, and this Hilbert space that we have is precisely the space of square integral functions with respect to this measure. So all this Cauchy completion, they really are well defined up here. So, but there's a catch, and as it has to be, because these are really, as I was just telling you, you think of these as being distributional. So indeed, in the non-abelian context, if I try to construct, for example, the field strength operator, you would expect that there will be some problem. And that is indeed the case. These objects are nice in the sense that as far as holonomies are concerned, they give you nice holonomies. But if you want to, it's not a Lie algebra valid one form from which I can construct a nice curvature. So the statement is that we don't know how to construct, I mean, curvature is not a well-defined quantity. And if you go back and look at Einstein's equations, of course, the curvature appears all over the place. And so the problem about regularization and such thing is really, in some sense, boils down to the fact that this is not a well-defined object. And then how are we going to handle it? And there are all these techniques that Jorge Pullin will finally tell you about. The last point is that this is space A bar. There's this construction, which I did not know, but I mean, it's apparently taught in the first year courses and graduate course in mathematics, which is this projective limit construction. So it really is true that this A bar, as Don was just telling us, is in fact a projective limit of this space's A gamma. A gamma was the quantum configuration space, which I may have written down. A gamma up here is the configuration space associated with this graph, which is g to the power n, basically. This is the lattice configuration space associated with this graph up here. And what A bar is really projected limit up here. That is to say, if you give me any of this thing, if you give me any of this A gamma, then there is a unique map by gamma from A bar to here. A bar is a generalized connection. In particular, it projects down to, I mean, element up here is a generalized connection. In particular, it projects down and gives me a connection on any of these graphs up here. But because of the projective limits of these things, what is being lost is that A bar can assign to any edge a group element, whereas element of A gamma assigns a group element only to the edges of gamma. Of a given gamma. So A bar has this infinitesimal information, which is being lost, and I'm getting only a finite dimensional information up here. And now, given any function up here, I can pull it back through this mapping, and defines me a function up here, and these were our cylindrical functions. The thing that I was talking about here, the simple functions, are exactly this. Just pull back functions from here, and the statement is that when you pull it back, you obtain a huge space of functions, because you're pulling it back from arbitrary possible A gammas. In other words, they are functions really of these generalized connections up here. In particular, of course, the space A that we started out with is embedded in the space A bar. Right? I mean, the generalized ordinary connections are elements of generalized connections, but this space is bigger. However, let me just say one thing and then I'll stop. However, because A bar is obtained as a projective limit of these spaces, and these spaces are all analytic manifolds grouped then. These are all good analytic manifolds. So we have on this A gammas all these operators defined, you know, I mean, vector fields, forms, various things that are perfectly well defined on this A gamma. And then you have to be very careful to see which of these objects go over and define for me an object on A bar. But the idea is that there are many objects, like vector fields, for example, which are defined on A gamma, which when you which, to this projective limit, actually give you nice objects on A bar up here. Okay. So this is how geometry is done. Okay. You're
Well, let me comment that might just...
Yeah, please.
A projective limit, if it sounds complicated, is really not. It's exactly the generalization of the idea of an infinite direct sum in cases where things overlap.
Right.
And so you usually find, when thinking of it that way, remember that
things don't overlap, you mean.
So you can do an infinite direct sum in cases where things don't overlap. The projective limit is exactly the generalization to the case where you allow things to overlap. And then this projection is just the moral equivalent of looking at the first five components in the individual vector.
I agree completely, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have a sort of general question now. So, you're presenting what looks like a very natural mathematical construction for this silver space, which sort of starts with these connections. But we have, you know, another big application of gauge theories, you know, which people have been using for ages and stuff, particle physics. So is this supposed to be giving a Hilbert space which is somehow physically equivalent to the one which comes out of a lot of gauge theories?
No. Because the Hilbert space...
gauge theory, you're very interested in
that
there
are
a fixed set of paths.
Right.
I said
except for one parameter.
Well, but you can let it space.
One parameter where you're taking this configuration which is a very good
thing. Huge thing. Right.
You have no way of doing this in practice for any waveform.
You mean on a computer or something?
Well,
you have a setup where you can only define things precisely, or you know, on a piece of paper on a computer for nasty for wave functions that you're probably not interested in, namely on finite graph.
No, no, but this can be restricted.
The lattice, the only wave function you're interested in is defined on the lattice, and then you just use the continuum mode, which means taking those graphs to infinity. Here, I don't know how you can, I mean, forgetting about the wave functions and the norm, the other question is, can you formulate the action in terms of these things?
I think that is part of the thing that the spin form people would talk about, right? I mean, how
because
to do the...
Normally, we don't care too much about the wave functions themselves, and the normal wave function has no particular...
No, but I mean, I think operators you do care about, and I can...
The measure is normally provided by the action. We're interested in small perturbations of the dynamics, tweaking space-time, which means we're interested in correlation functions. And the measure that's picked out is not the DA that enters into this norm, which I don't care about anyway.
Right.
But rather into the norm, into the action.
No, I think there are two different issues here. I mean,
that's what we care about for the dynamics.
But I mean, I may also be interested in Hamiltonian, for example. I may want to know what the spectrum of Hamiltonian is. Is
the operator?
Right, right. So this, I mean, but I can't tell you what the operator is before I tell you what the Hilbert space is, right? Because then, I mean, that's what we're going to do. We're going to study these geometric operators, why? And next time. Anyway, these are all going to be operators defined on this Hilbert space, and it is on this Hilbert space that we'll be able to compute the spectra and such things. I'm agreeing with you that we can only deal very quickly with sort of simple operators, which are the property that, for example, leave invariant states associated with the graph. They map the states associated with any graph to states associated with that graph. If you have such operators, you can actually do things more quickly. If you have more complicated operators, then you have to do a lot of work. But I mean, people are doing that, exactly.
People are interested in different things.
Right.
I guess what I was trying to ask was, think of a different question, equivalent. So you said that this is not equivalent.
Right. So I just wanted to try it again. So the thing is that I thought you were asking about the continuum limit. Right. Yeah. Now, if you take continuum limit of the gauge theory or something, then that limit, the measure in the Hilbert space, morally, has the information about action. It is somehow constructed. I mean, this Ostermolisch order, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's how it is constructed. So this is really kinematical stuff here. I mean, it doesn't know anything about, this is because this is supposed to be geometry in which you sort of formulate things. So this Hilbert space, this is a good point to sort of emphasize, this Hilbert space is not the space of physical states of quantum gravity. This Hilbert space is the first thing we need to even formulate the equations, to even ask the questions that we want to ask, basically. So this Hilbert space is the quantum analog of the full phase space of general relativity. It is it's not completely contentless, but it is pretty tame. I mean, it's not too much information there. And that is why this does not have information about dynamics, etc., etc. However, we need this Hilbert space to even formulate the quantum constraints. We need this Hilbert space to even write down what you mean by, area operator, volume operator, etc., etc. Normally, we don't need that in quantum mechanics, but in quantum field theory, constrained quantum field theory, we need something like that, which we don't have too much experience with. Okay.
How
bad
can you generalize could I take a third path whose endpoint... such that the group element I got depended on which point in a Cantor set the endpoint landed in, or something insanely horrible like that, or is that irrelevant to the whole
construction? I think it's safe to say that most of the space, to a measurement subset of this state of things.
It's horrible.
It's horrible. Yeah, it's right, exactly. Yeah. So the connections, which will include things like that. Right.
But that's not a problem.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's true. I don't know. I mean, when first begins even free field theory, right? I mean, the statement that we really, I mean, it's pretty tame by now. We understand that, but the statement that we had to consider distributions is pretty. I mean, these are short distributions. They're not just delta distributions. They're sort of distributions. I can take arbitrary number of derivatives. So, and so.
So the Hamiltonian should tell you from among all of those. Functions,
sort of
which are the ones where the wave function is concentrated.
Yeah, there are two issues. One is, by the way, I mean, this is not a very profound statement, but this step-by-step procedure that T-man has can be carried out in 2 plus 1 gravity. I mean, it's a very long way of solving 2 plus 1 gravity, but if you like, it is a method. You can check on the method. And the statement is that then you get loads and loads of solutions to the quantum constraints. And it really is the inner product, finally, which limits you. From these loads and loads of solutions, and with the physical, you know, it's almost then. But the important thing is that you do get normal solutions. This is the point I'm making. Normals and the classical solutions that we hope to get, we do get out of all this.
But in 2 plus 1, if you impose the constraints, then presumably you can get rid of most of the graphs.
Well, I think it depends on how you impose the constraints. I mean, if we impose a constraint by saying that f is equal to 0,
yeah,
then immediately the you know what to do. I mean, sort of. But if I want to be sort of say test the method. So in 3 plus 1, f is not equal to 0. But in 3 plus 1, you have got this constraint that I wrote down, e cross, trace of e cross b is equal to 0, etc. So we want to take the same form of the constraints in 2 plus 1. So it's a very long way of doing 2 plus 1. But nonetheless, I mean, it is a test on what one is doing in the full case. I mean, are we doing completely crazy things that or not? This is just sort of trying to answer this question that, in fact, if I did step by step, the thing that Thomas Thiemann has done for 3 plus 1 gravity, then we do, among things that, we get lots of wild things, but among them we do get the usual things, and then finiteness of norms does pick out the usual thing. Sorry, Jim.
What's left of the connection of loop states?
Not very much. I mean, ultimately, I mean, it's not that it is not, it's wrong or anything. It's just sort of not convenient anymore. I mean, everything is being done in terms of these graphs and spin networks and so on. Yeah. So loops are being replaced by graphs. I mean, when you said loop, I was taking literally loop, closed loops. But there is no.
There still is a space of loops if you have a transformation from these wave functions.
Oh yeah.
Went backwards, right? But it's just.
It's not very useful at the moment, at least, you know, unless one finds some technical insight at the moment. Okay, it's not too bad. I got two, three things, and so next time I'll begin with one.